From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. As soon as human beings began to realize they were different from the animals around them, they started to draw pictures. Archaeologists have found cave drawings that go back 30,000 years. Later on, we'll meet a poet who studied those ancient drawings. Also today, an old master of American literature tackles one of Spain's greatest painters, Evan S. Cannell, on Francisco Goya.
Up until that time, nudes had been allegories, mythological goddesses, and Goya seems to have been the first who painted a particular Spanish woman, and I think this was shocking and outrageous.
Also today, novelist Susan Vreeland explains how her work differs from a biographer's.
I can't follow a biography where every event is given equal attention. A historical novelist has to keep in mind that they're writing a novel.
Susan Vreeland's been dressing up the bestseller list the last couple of years with a series of novels about painters and their subjects. She started with Vermeer and a novel called Girl in Hyacinth Blue. Then there was The Passion of Artemisia, about a female Renaissance artist. And now she's tackled the life of Canadian icon Emily Carr in a book called The Forest Lover. Here she is with a brief excerpt.
If there was any kind of portrait worth doing, it would be the portrait of a tree. But a portrait had to convey character. The channels in this cedar's raw umber trunk all stretched upward, reaching toward light. It was more than a tree, however noble. It was the manifestation of the attitude that had brought her this far, reaching. Not just the tree, but that idea was her subject. The things in a painting were only bits of visible evidence of a still, small voice whispering a truth.
Susan Vreeland, reading from The Forest Lover. Emily Carr was born into Vancouver society at the turn of the 20th century. She decided to become an artist. That was bad enough, but what really shocked her family was her sympathy for British Columbia's tribal people and her appreciation of their art and culture.
Here was a woman in the early 20th century who traveled alone against the confines of her strict family to native villages, up rivers in canoes, out to the Queen Charlotte Islands, to places where white women did not travel, even if they were with men, and she did it alone, to Indian villages to paint. Now, I use the word Indian because that was her term. That was the vernacular of the time.
Was it that desire to rebel that led her away, or was it the need to find an expression of art that led her into the adventures, do you think?
It was the latter. She felt that native art conveyed something of primitive Western Canada before white man by their carvings on their poles and on their homes, which brought to life the animistic spirits that they felt lived in the forest.
Was it her choice of subject that caused her to be such an outcast from
her time? Not entirely.
I mean, would it have been enough for her to be an outcast just to have become an artist?
No. There were other women who were artists. They painted in watercolor, and normally their subject matter was either portrait or flowers.
Now, she did study art first. She
Yes.
more or less pursued the normal...
At first. She went to art school, first in San Francisco and then in London. But in London, they only taught women watercolor. And she felt her big province and those trees 200 feet tall, and those striking totems deserved a bolder treatment in paint. So she needed to learn to paint in oils. And for that, she had to go to France. That was in 1911, when Paris was bursting into modernism. So she came back with a variety of ways of seeing that were entirely new. She'd been exposed to Impressionism, Post-Impressionism, Cubism, Fauvism, Expressionism. And she tried them all.
But they weren't enough.
They were not enough to convince people in Victoria and Vancouver that she was an artist of merit. They ridiculed her. So now it was not just subject matter that went against the conventional grain, but style as well.
Yeah. Now, what was it? You talked about the passion of the native art. Was it the native art that actually drew her, or was it the First Nations culture that drew her? Do you know?
Both. First, the art seemed very sophisticated to her and very much alive. Working in a spiritual realm, she often spoke that the totem carver would get at the spirit of the totem figure first and not look from the outside in, but look from the inside out. Hmm. That appealed to her. But in addition, the indigenous cultures had a philosophy that appealed to her. And the first tribe that she visited, the Nuchalnuth, have a phrase that expresses this. It's Hishuktsawak, and it means everything is one. Man, animals, plants, sky, waves, all are expressions of a single spirit.
Once she got there and was in the place she wanted to be, began to paint the kinds of things that had appealed to her, did it change her art?
I think the simplicity of the sculpted forms encouraged her to simplify not just the poles that she was painting, but the forests themselves and the shapes of the branches turned into solid sculpted forms. Not little, you know, she didn't paint it little leaves on the tree anymore.
You don't see the needles on the fir trees.
No. This is bold sculptural trees.
Now, is this really a straightforward story? You're a historical novelist.
Yes, I am.
Taken a real character.
Yes.
And used many of the real events in her life. But rarely do real lives lend themselves to straightforward telling.
No.
Did you have to invent Emily Carr?
I tell you, I see the discipline of a historical fiction writer as worlds apart from a biographer. A biographer carries a life from birth to death, covering everything that that researcher can find. And that provides wonderful raw material for a historical novelist.
You need to go do the research.
But I can't follow a biography where every event is given equal attention. A historical novelist has to keep in mind that they're writing a novel. They have certain themes that they want to explore. And any biographical material that doesn't contribute to those themes, we don't have space for.
There must be days, though, when you're sitting in your studio writing and you're thinking, I wanted to use that. It doesn't forward my story, so I can't use it. But I really wanted to use that piece of information.
That surprisingly didn't happen as much as you might think. Now, the reverse of finding something that you don't want to use is looking for something and not finding it. And on those occasions, one has to invent. How did she learn so much about where the poles were? I had to invent people that she could speak to and learn from.
Now, this is the third of your novels that deals with painters.
That's right.
Do you find yourself understanding painters? I mean, I guess the question really should be, what is there about painters that draws you as a writer in?
I've always been surrounded by art in my family since childhood. So it was very common to talk about colors and interpretations of scenes. Paintings have been an uplifting force to me, particularly in low periods of my life. I went through a life-threatening health problem. I was working on both my first novel, Girl in Hyacinth Blue, about a Vermeer painting, and The Forest Lover. And so both Emily Carr and Vermeer so totally different, gave me a spirit.
A strength.
Well, Emily gave me strength. Vermeer gave me tranquility. And I'm so grateful for what they gave me that I want to share with other people who may not be museum goers. They may be readers, but not art lovers. The tremendous upliftment and healing that can come from just giving yourself to a painting.
Susan Vreeland's latest novel is called The Forest Lover. The art world has rediscovered Francisco Goya. So have intellectuals like Susan Sontag and art critic Robert Hughes. A new biography by Evan S. Cannell may bring the 18th century master to the bestseller lists. Cannell's the author of 18 books, both novels and nonfiction. Son of the Morning Star is his classic book about Custer. Cannell also wrote a pair of novels called Mr. Bridges and Mrs. Bridges. They became a movie starring Paul Newman and Joanne Woodward. Evan Cannell lives and works in Santa Fe and talked with Anne Strainchamps.
I think Americans in general are taught that the Sun King and Marie Antoinette are kind of the models of heartless aristocrats. Reading your book, the Spanish Bourbons were appalling.
That's a general opinion, yes. Ferdinand, I think most historians regard Ferdinand as the worst king Spain ever had, and he does sound dreadful.
What was so awful about them?
Well, frivolous, degenerate. Goya became a figure when Charles III was in power, and then he served under his son, Charles IV, and then under Joseph Bonaparte while Napoleon controlled Spain. And subsequently, Ferdinand VII, who was the son of Charles IV. Goya was born in 1746, and he lived quite a long time. He died in 1828. So he lived through extremely uneven times.
Kind of the dissolution of the Spanish monarchy?
Yes, and he, toward the end of his life, he became so alarmed and uneasy that he fled to Bordeaux, where he died. A good many Spaniards couldn't take the fascistic monarchy of Ferdinand VII, the resurrection of the Inquisition, and the general oppressive nature of Spain in those days. Good many of the intellectuals just gave up. They were, in fact, very much afraid for their lives.
Now, Goya was, for part of his life, almost a court painter, and one of his most famous paintings, his early most famous painting, is a really big canvas he did that shows the entire royal family. And tell me about this one, because this is the painting that I think Ernest Hemingway called it a masterpiece of loathing.
Yes. It was Charles IV and his family. Everybody has a different opinion of it. Some of the quite knowledgeable critics think it was simply a magnificent portrait of the royal family. Others, such as Hemingway, think that it was a terrible satire on the court.
Why is it a satire? What do you see when you look at it?
It depends on who you are. It depends on what you see. You know, looking at a painting is totally subjective. Two people looking at the same painting will have very different opinions. I myself think it's both, that it's satirical and at the same time it is wonderfully executed.
What do the people look like?
Well, Charles looks rather bloated, covered with medals, and Maria Luisa, his queen, is sort of indescribable. I think Napoleon once commented that her character was written on her face and it was indescribable.
What, I mean in a good way, a bad way? She was a horrible person, a saint?
She was almost certainly a nymphomaniac, and these people, they were in absolute control of Spain, and they did whatever they wanted to do whenever they wanted to do it, with very little regard to anyone else. And this ultimately led, I suppose, to the termination of the Bourbon monarchy.
This was a family that also said they were vicious to each other as well as to other people. Isn't there a story that the queen said when she first saw Ferdinand, the prince she was to marry, he was so ugly she nearly fainted?
Yes. And Goya in that... And the portrait seems to have flattered him somewhat. He evidently was extremely short, and according to one report, he had no legs at all. But Goya showed a man who was, to my way of thinking, was conceited, selfish, self-centered, but more or less normal in appearance. It's difficult to reconcile sometimes the written accounts of contemporaries with the visual results of court painters.
What distinguished Goya's painting, his vision at this time?
He changed. He began as a drawing, they were called cartoons for the Royal Tapestry Factory. It was paid reasonably well, and he was a young man, and he got a job there. And then he, of course, aspired to much greater things, and he worked his way into a job as a court painter, and then worked up the ladder, becoming finally the supreme court painter. And he evolved, as all artists do. Some of the early work seems quite trivial. Not only the paintings, but his famous Disasters of War, which resulted from what he saw of the Napoleonic invasion. Just horrifying, a record of what happened in those days.
I'm so curious about Goya himself and what must have happened to him, because he began as a court painter, painting these grand portraits of the king and queen and their family, but he's best known as a war painter, as the person who created these horrific images of wartime brutality. What happened?
He observed what he saw. I mean, he observed what was going on. All of us, I think, go through this evolutionary process. You look at the enormous change in Picasso's work over the years, or even Renoir, a fairly traditional painter. And I don't think this in itself is unusual. It's customary. You observe and think about it. And well, Goya spent several years thinking about the revolt of May 2nd before he actually got around to painting it. And it's percolated in his mind for a long time, and finally he understood what he wanted to say about it.
They're so horrific that it makes them seem very modern.
Yes,
was he the first to have done something like that?
I think so. They say that up until Goya's time, artists who wanted to represent war saw it as a glorious battle with armor flashing in the sunlight and cavalry charges and flags and plumes and spectacular panorama, kind of a Hollywood type of production. But Goya looked beneath that to see what was really there, the bayoneting of civilians and, well, the figurative crucifixion of innocent people. And that is what he understood war to be, in contrast to the glorious pageantry of the past.
What are his most famous war paintings, war images?
The most famous images, I think, are not of the war. Those were mostly lithographs, drawings, whatnot. Well, the pair of twins, the Maya Vestida and the Maya Desnuda, which have been reproduced on everything from postage stamps to coffee cups these days. There was a great mystery about whether or not the model was the Duchess of Alba, with whom he repeatedly had an affair.
This is the famous nude?
Yes, the woman is lying on a couch in one. She is flimsily dressed in a kind of harem costume, and the other she is nude, and this was created a great scandal.
Why? Because she was naked?
Yes. The Inquisition very much frowned upon nudes, and probably the only thing that saved Goya when he was brought up before the Inquisition was the fact that his defense could point to the famous nude by Velázquez, which Philip II, I think, had greatly admired. Then they could point to the great paintings by Titian and so forth, who, of course, was Italian, not Spanish. Anyway, they related what Goya had done to classic nudes of the past, and this permitted him to squeeze through the clutches of the Inquisition, but it was a pretty close call. He must have been very frightened in those days.
The painting was controversial beyond the fact that it was a nude in the Inquisition wasn't crazy about nudes. I mean, people through the centuries have either seemed to love it or hate it. What is it about that painting that seems to inspire such strong feeling?
I don't really know. It is a painting of a particular Spanish woman. Up until that time, nudes had been allegories, mythological goddesses. And Goya seems to have been the first who painted a particular Spanish woman, and I think this was shocking and outrageous.
Is it true that Edgar Degas complained that after Goya he was condemned to painting a housewife in her bathtub?
That is what he said. I think it's a marvelous comment.
What did he mean?
Well, that Goya had simply annihilated this centuries-old tradition of mythological women. He had painted this particular woman, whoever she may have been. It may have been just a generic face. There are rumors that she was any number of different people, who the model was. We don't know. We will never know.
But the idea was that instead of painting an idealized, beautiful image of a woman, he painted a real woman, warts and all.
Yes, a Spanish woman that you might see on the streets of Madrid. And this was a great departure from the past.
He was an artist who was committed to painting what he really saw, and I guess that's part of his war images also. But how did he survive as an artist when he was surrounded by intellectual repression and political turmoil? The Inquisition was stronger than ever.
He was very careful. He had worked very hard to get where he was in the Spanish court. And, well, unquestionably, his sentiments were liberal in this repressive government. But I think he was quite cautious. He didn't want to destroy his career by some injudicious remark or act, and he walked carefully through that court. What mattered to him more than anything else was the chance to continue doing his work, his life work, which he was an artist from top to bottom, and nothing else was as important as that.
Evan S. Cannell talked with Anne Strangechamps. His latest book is Francisco Goya, A Life. Next up, the caves of Lascaux, where nothing was as important to our ancestors as drawing pictures on the walls. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Staring at a painting might seem like a pretty rarefied form of pleasure, a sophisticated and cerebral sort of entertainment. And maybe it is, if it's a rainy Sunday afternoon and you're hanging out at a museum studying the Goyas or the Emily Carrs. But cast your imagination back 20,000 years. Humans have just begun to discover who they are and how they're different from the animals around them. They gather together in caves deep underground at places like Lascaux in France. Poet Clayton Eshelman thinks the paintings they made on the walls there are amazing. He interprets them in a book called Juniper Fuse. Eshelman told Steve Paulson that sites like Lascaux show our ancestors becoming people like us.
Lascaux is hard to describe in the sense that the work is so beautiful and perfect and bravura that if you walked into an art gallery in New York City this afternoon and saw some of the images from Lascaux, they would be absolutely in time, and one could believe that they were painted yesterday. So there's a curious, eternal aspect to Lascaux that seems to have no messing around or sort of apprentice work in it. It seems to be the culmination of a vision of life at that time that was rendered with the force of, you know, a Shakespeare or a Blake.
Do we know when the Lascaux paintings were done?
Well, they appear to have been done in the last interstadial during the Magdalenian, which is to say around 16,000 to 16,500 years ago.
And I guess scientists have concluded that the brains of those early humans were pretty much the way we are today. I mean, obviously, their worldview was entirely different, but physically, they were pretty much like we are now.
Yeah, they say that were a Cro-Magnon to walk through the room, why, he would look just like us. That's not true for Neanderthal. But the Cro-Magnon people had more or less the same brains that we had, and I think they were extraordinarily intelligent, perhaps smarter than we are.
Perhaps smarter than we are.
If we read the caves in terms of document, you know, which is tricky to do because only so much has survived and there's still a lot of stuff probably to be discovered, there's no warfare. There's no indication of violence on any kind of significant scale. So when I say smarter than we are, why, I'm responding to what seems to be a vision of the world rendered in Upper Paleolithic image making that is more human than the world we live in today.
Now, you've spent time in these caves, and you've been to Lascaux, you've been to other caves that mm-hmm. have this mm-hmm. ancient art. What's it like being in a cave?
Well, one response to your question is that I didn't have the amount of time in the dark in the cave that I would have liked to have because I was always with a guide, and I was never allowed to spend, you know, real sensory deprivational time in a cave, such as, say, Barbara McLeod was able to do in Belize and Guatemala. And after you're in the dark for a while, well, you begin to hear and see things and think things that you don't think otherwise. So I was always, you know, with a guide passing through. Originally, I just went in as a tourist, and then I got permission to go into caves that are not available to the tourists. So my work on the cave was not only, you know, visiting them time and time again, but there was a lot of work that I did in the library.
But part of what you're saying is that the whole experience of this cave art is it's not just seeing the pictures on the walls there, it's the setting. It's the fact that it is in this world that's sealed from the outside. And there must be, I don't know, at some psychic level, a different kind of interaction with the world.
Sure. I mean, the caves are a kind of an alien dreamlike landscape that have curious forms of their own in, you know, that are often organic and remind you of bodily organs. At the same time that they're part of our world, you know, they are an underworld, an otherworld. And I think that much of the response that one has to the caves generates a kind of thinking that leads to image making in the first place.
What are some of the most striking images that you've seen in cave art?
Well, the most engaging ones for me were certain narrative sequences, which are rare. I mean, most of the animals, which are generally bison or horses, are done in isolation. In other words, there is no narrative relationship between two animals or an animal and something else in the cave. For me, there's no way that you could sort of read it as a hunting scene or something that is involved with, you know, let's say, observational reality.
And that's the traditional interpretation, right, that these people would paint scenes from hunting, maybe as wish fulfillment, that if they show an animal being killed, then they will go out and have luck on their own hunt, something along those lines.
Yeah, something called the hunting hypothesis, which was popularized by Robert Ardrey. But this began to disappear in the 50s and 60s, actually, and it's pretty much discredited now. And there are current theories that do involve shamanism, which I partially subscribe to. I think there's around 30 figures in Upper Paleolithic image making that can be read as what I would call proto-shamanic, in other words, the origins of shamanism, in which there is a mental reality that's being discovered and being described in the paintings of these figures that are generally grotesque and hybrid, often with bird heads and bison heads.
And one thing about shamans is they often serve as bridges between the animal world, or you might even call it the spirit world, and the more empirical human world that we all know.
Mm-hmm. That's right. And I think that in the shamanism, you find the roots of poetry.
How so?
Well, the shaman is a mental traveler, to borrow William Blake's phrase. And the mental traveler is one who is beginning to make up reality and to take trips, as it were, into realms that are outside of the observational world. And this is basically, I think, what poetry is about. It's reinventing or redesigning a mental world in reaction to the way things are.
Now, I would think this particular moment in our prehistory, whether it's 16,000 years ago or maybe even longer ago, must have been extraordinary, because I suppose what's really going on is humans are starting to become self-conscious. I mean, they are realizing that they are fundamentally different from the other animals out there, but yet their lives are intimately connected to those animals. For one thing, they're eating them. And I suppose this art must come out of that in some way.
Yeah, well, I think you put your finger on something that is key to my reading, at least, of it, is that I think that we're looking at the point in which human beings began to separate the animal out of their about-to-be-human heads. And so that the animals become projections onto the cave walls, out of the heads of the Cro-Magnon people. And there is an interaction in the darkness, in the stone, that enables them to begin to project the animals out of their heads. And as this takes place, I think there's a reaction to it. And that's where my sense of the proto-shamanic activity comes in, that as they begin to separate out, they also begin to rebind. Because the loss of the animal sets off a second reaction. And I think that that's where you get the hybrid figures in which you have then the seeds of the shamanic paradise in which human beings are in contact, in mystical contact with animals, having conversations with them, traveling with them, et cetera, et cetera. So that's sort of, in a sense, my two-part thesis.
Do you think there are still important discoveries to be made about this ancient cave art?
Probably, and there's probably also many caves to be discovered. They discover in France about one a year. In fact, I'm going to one that was discovered in 1994. It's called Chauvet, and it's in the Ardèche region of France, which has about 12 other caves, but nothing like Chauvet. And Chauvet has the earliest dated paintings, dated as early as 32,000 years ago. A black hairy rhinoceros is carbon dated at that. And so with the event of Chauvet, which sort of challenged a lot of the dating and a lot of the theories about cave art, makes you realize that there's still stuff out there that's sealed over and will be discovered. In terms of theories about it, I really don't know. I mean, I pushed as far as I could to get to my theory, and there's other people, you know, that have different theories, and we're all, you know, it's nothing more than theory and vision. I don't think that there's any way that one can get back to an exact understanding of the caves that would register with the way the Cro-Magnon people themselves saw the caves. In other words, when we were looking at an animal in, say, Lascaux that has some mysterious signs on the cover of my book, Juniper Fuse, why there is an image of a stag with fantastic antlers and under the stag why there's 13 black dots and a rectangle. And it's pretty clear that the dots in the rectangle being right below the stag are in some sort of narrative relationship to the animal. I don't think that we'll ever know how to read those dots and rectangles. I don't think there's a way that one can crack that.
Clayton Eshelman is a poet and the author of the book Juniper Fuse, Upper Paleolithic Imagination and the Construction of the Underworld. He spoke with Steve Paulson. In the modern world, we have art critics to tell us what paintings mean. Not that there's only one right answer, or that only critics have it. Later this hour, an art critic trashes the elitism of his profession.
What can seem elitist is the idea that there's good and bad, and that there are people who understand art better than other people. But you don't know who that's going to be. And so my feeling is, no, let's have lots of people go to lots of shows, let's have lots of things on the wall. Let's just, you know, keep it as open as possible. Run a lot of people by. That's fine with me.
I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. In his latest novel, Larry Watson tells a story about beauty, art, obsession, and betrayal. Orchard revolves around an artist named Ned Weaver, Sonia, his model and muse, and both of their spouses. Here's Larry Watson with a brief scene.
Weaver had never known a model with this woman's talent for stillness, and talent was the word for it. For that, she did not have to be taught or trained. she did not have to be reminded or cajoled. When told to pose in a particular position, she assumed it immediately and held it without protest. Without protest, beyond that, she took to motionlessness as eagerly as if stasis were her natural state and she had been waiting for a reason to return to it. Occasionally, Weaver's curiosity, or was it his perversity, led him to test the limits of her talent. He devised poses difficult to hold, like this one, which required her to kneel on the bed but keep her body's jointed parts strictly aligned and perfectly angled, head in line with shoulders and hips, arms straight down at her sides, knees bent at 90 degrees. Weaver wanted all the curves in this pose to come only from the parts of her she could not control, as if her eroticism were asserting itself without her consent. Weaver thought that forcing her to hold that pose, how her trapezius muscles must have knotted themselves with the effort of holding her head up, how her knees must have ached, might break her down, might force her to ask him for relief. It did not. Weaver had also hoped, when he first conceived of the pose, not merely out of a mild malice, but out of aesthetic intent as well, that it might at last reveal the secret of her. It did not.
Exploring the tangled relationship of the mysterious model, Sonia, and the brilliant but not especially admirable artist, Ned Weaver, keeps Larry Watson busy throughout his most recent novel. Larry, you didn't make things any easier on yourself when you planned the book's architecture. I mean, Orchard has an unusual and complicated structure, doesn't it?
Somebody in a bookstore recently said, well, this novel takes place in just a single day with flashbacks and flash forwards, and that probably works as well as anything.
The other thing that I like about that particular passage, I think, is that it brings out both characters' commitment to the art, but also it brings out Weaver's taste for cruelty.
Taste for cruelty. That's very good. That's very good. Someone asked me recently in an interview about what it was like to write about Ned Weaver, and I said that it worked out pretty well, that he gave me an opportunity to get in touch with my inner bastard.
Well, and what I'm interested in, I guess, is the question that seems to me you address throughout the story of whether there is any connection between art and ethics.
I think there's a very large question. I happen personally to believe that artists don't get a buy just because they make art, that they have the same ethical duties and responsibilities of any other citizen. But I have certainly known of people, writers in particular, who have felt as though they were excused because they made art.
Is it so much a question of their feeling excused, or, as Weaver says at one point in your story, the only part of his life that matters is the art. What he does the rest of the time is unimportant.
That's right. I mean, he is, on the one hand, a supreme egotist, and yet somebody who thinks of himself as unimportant, simply the vehicle for this important thing, which is the work of art.
In this case, you have two couples, Weaver and his wife, Harriet, mm-hmm. Sonia and her husband, Henry House. And there's a question, it seems to me, in each of their minds of whether the art excuses action.
Yes, I think that's certainly true for Harriet, who works very hard at overlooking her husband's shortcomings and who continues to believe, in spite of the fact that he provides her no evidence of this, of his goodness. Her only evidence for this comes not from his day-to-day behavior, but from something that comes out in his art. And so she believes this must be in him and waits patiently, has been waiting patiently for this to emerge in the man.
The man, as you said, it allowed you to get in touch with your inner bastard.
Yes.
His is pretty well displayed. He's not just willing to be cruel to his model. He's willing to betray his wife, and even his friends?
Sometimes it is deliberate cruelty, as if he's simply looking for a way to amuse himself and to pass the time. But sometimes his cruelty, I think, is the result of his being insensitive in a way that some people are who are simply out of it, who don't understand very well how human beings operate and what their feelings are.
But doesn't this make you question then the value of art? Because the way you describe his paintings, it's absolutely clear that in his paintings, he touches people in very real ways and not cruel ways.
It's a paradox, I think. It's a huge paradox. I was in a bookstore in Chicago recently, and someone quoted Donald Hall to me. I don't think I'll get this right, but here is the gist of it, that Donald Hall said, and this might have been by way of another artist, perhaps Ezra Pound, who said that there had never been a first-rate writer who was a good husband and father. And I think I understand the run of that, and its implication is that good husbands and good fathers compromise in their lives, and that once compromise enters one's life, that means it can enter one's art as well.
The flip of that would be that the great artist must devote everything that matters to the art, and devoting anything that matters to the rest of life would take away from art.
Exactly, exactly. I'm going to be in Oxford, Mississippi later this week at William Faulkner's home, and I think Faulkner said something like that a novel is worth any number of dead grandmothers.
It's a scary thought, isn't it?
It is, yeah, it is.
You know, we're condemning the artist in a way, at least in conventional senses, but in your novel there is room for condemnation of those who are not artists. Sonia's husband, bereft by grief, their son is either killed or died, it isn't clear, treats his wife as badly without the excuse of art.
That's right. I would say Henry lacks imagination, and I'm not sure that it's the same sort of imagination that Ned Weaver has, but Henry House, like a lot of people, has difficulty imagining his way into other people's lives.
And there, we talk about the difficulty, the association of ethics with art. Henry House looks at that and demands ethics without the art.
Yes, exactly. That's right. That's right. I go back and forth. You know, I don't think that the Ned Weavers of the world are justified. I don't think they're right. But of course, an artist must be supremely confident of the value of his or her work to believe that that work of art has more importance than human feelings.
Did you learn anything about your art in writing about his?
Yes, I did. And I think it probably had as much to do with the novel's structure, the playing around with time. I thought that telling the story in a non-linear way, and again, this is something that I sort of came to during the process, I certainly didn't know this when I began, was that it might allow me to do something that was a writerly version of an Impressionist painting, so that by not putting the sections in a strictly chronological order, it asked for readers to participate in the making of the work, just as Impressionist paintings, I think, that sometimes with a dab of color or a certain kind of brush stroke, ask the viewers to participate in the making of the painting.
Are you comfortable with the way that it worked?
I am in this way. It was the way the novel seemed to say to me, write me this way. And so I obeyed that and felt as though it worked out okay. I was very uneasy about it, and at some point I reshuffled the sections to see what a chronological version would be like. But I obeyed some instinct in making the novel this way, and that it works out okay for readers is pleasing.
Larry Watson is the author of several novels. His latest is called Orchard. Michael Fried is a serious critic and art historian. His books are aimed at scholars. His essays appeal to connoisseurs. So you might pity the poor radio interviewer who had to make intelligent conversation with this paragon of aesthetic sensibility. But Steve Paulson discovered Fried's a really friendly guy who's easy to talk to.
I've heard that you used to hang out with the famous art critic Clement Greenberg.
Yes, I knew Greenberg well. I went to Princeton at 16, and within a couple of months of, I went there to be a scientist, and then I discovered poetry and I discovered art. I had actually gone to art school and stuff like that when I was younger. I'd painted. But I became friends with the painter Frank Stella. I was a freshman and he was a sophomore. We, you know, connected then. And Stella and I and another artist at Princeton in those years, a man named Darby Bannard, all became aware of Greenberg as a critic. Greenberg at that point really wasn't writing publicly very much, but he had written. And his was the one body of writing about contemporary art that seemed really helpful and useful to us. And I owe a lot to Stella and others in that kind of awareness. Also, we were, remarkable things were happening in New York, and Princeton was kind of an hour away, and the trains were running. So I really got very involved in contemporary art while still an undergraduate. And in the spring of my junior year, so I was going from being 18 to 19, I got Greenberg's address and wrote to him. This was before the publication of his selected essays. Art and Culture, I think, came out in 1961. And I wrote him and said, could I come and visit him? The kind of thing you do when you're young. And he said yes, and I came there. And this, it must have been sort of like May 58 or something. And then I knew him from that moment. I then went to England for 3 years. I had a Rhodes Scholarship at Oxford for 2 years. Then I lived in London for a year. And I had done trial art reviews, too, for Hilton Kramer, who was then editor of Arts Magazine. It's a long story, but I suddenly was at 22 living in London, a special student in philosophy, and the London correspondent for Arts Magazine.
It was not a bad life.
It was very, very heady. The very first opening I went to, I sat opposite a guy at dinner, and that was the British sculptor Anthony Caro. And I went and saw his work the next weekend and was overwhelmed by it. And we've been friends till. And then when I returned to America, I saw a lot of Greenberg. I was then a graduate student in art history at Harvard. But once a month, I would go to New York and stay with Frank Stella and his then wife, Barbara Rose, for about 3 days and go around and see exhibitions, go back, write my New York letter then for a magazine called Art International, and go back to being a graduate student. But I saw a lot of Greenberg.
Did you look at art together?
Yes, yes.
And I mean, so you would talk about it then?
Oh, yeah, and went to studios together. And when I was working on Morris Lewis, we would go to the warehouse and look at in effect, I was apprenticed to Lewis, to Greenberg, as a young critic, as other people in my generation were. This wasn't, a unique status for me. And also, as with most other people in my generation who went through this, at a certain point, being around Greenberg became impossible. I mean, he was a... it's a euphemism to say a very difficult man.
Overbearing, to put it mildly.
Yeah, and also unpleasant. I mean, ultimately a killer. I mean, he was encouraging to one at the very, very beginning, and then as you became something other than just an utter beginner, almost invariably turned on you, and you had to just stop seeing. And that happened with me. It happened with lots of us. But I was formed as an art critic, reading Greenberg, being around Greenberg,
now Greenberg,
reacting against Greenberg. You know, it's just a major figure dialectically in critical life.
Now, Greenberg is probably most famous for championing abstract expressionists like Jackson Pollock.
And then color field abstraction afterwards. And yes.
And so was that the art that you tended to look at with him?
Yes, and color field art. I mean, more art after. Mm-hmm. After abstract expressionism. So Morris Lewis, Kenneth Nolan, Jules Olitsky, Caro himself. I mean, it's a strange moment now. Greenberg was such a dominant figure. And he also was, in various ways, such a thug and a bully. But he was also just, he was one of these people who was just extremely strong psychically. I mean, if he were in a room, you'd feel these kind of waves of psychic disturbances. There were a meter that could register it. And he intimidated the hell out of people. He took such a strong stand. No, I would say early on, all of us would sort of, but no, I mean, we all had to break with him. No, I would say not. And that, I think, was part of the problem. I mean, this is what I would like to think. Mm-hmm. You're sort of shattering. You had to go through this whole experience with Clem. And he was also making such strong claims about the quality of certain art and the lack of quality in certain other kinds of art that since he died, everyone is thrilled. He's not around anymore. And so they've turned against him, but also against all the art that he championed. All the art he championed, I don't mean Pollock, but say color field abstract. That's all in purgatory. If you go to certain kinds of places where contemporary art hangs, museums where it hangs, you'll suddenly, that painting is in storage at this moment. I've actually been going around making a proposal, and that is that we do it what the Restoration did with Oliver Cromwell. Dig him up, hang him, behead him, burn him.
and get past it. I mean, let's get the revenge over with and then get this art out of purgatory and go on. But as it is, I think it's going to be like another 20 years. It's going to require probably the death from old age of everybody who is intimidated by Clement Greenberg.
But you're really talking about the power of one art critic. I mean, not an artist, but a critic who really shaped a generation's response to art.
That's right. I think so. He was sort of archaic to talk this way, but he had a very good eye. He wrote very powerfully. And then he just was psychically, I mean, he's a very dominating kind of figure. And it's not that he was always right, but, I mean, if you want to see how good he is, you can even forget what he wrote about contemporary art. But look at the essay he wrote on Cézanne. Look at the essay called Collage. I mean, those are stunning essays.
Does art still thrill you?
Yeah, absolutely. Totally.
You still have this, you can have that same feeling of freshness, of wow, that you did when you were 19?
Yeah, totally. Absolutely. Actually, a sweet moment yesterday with a graduate student who we were looking at, I was showing them some Clifford Stills and Barnett Newman's in the National Gallery and sort of talking about them, and a Pollock, a great Pollock, called Lavender Mist. And I was talking about the kind of incommensurable explosion that took place in American art at that moment and how we still don't fully have our heads around it. And she said to me, well, you say all that, but, you know, do you think it's as great as Cézanne? And so I answered that as best I could. You'd say, look, it is hard to compare over those, but yes, I think it's at least as extraordinary in a certain way. And she said, you really are a hard case. And she meant it very sweetly, and I took it very sweetly. I said, yes, you know, yes, I absolutely love art and poetry. I'm just thrilled that this turns out to be a way I can spend my life.
Art historian Michael Fried teaches at Johns Hopkins and has published many books of art criticism. He talked to Steve Paulson. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. To buy this program on cassette, call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Ask for program number 37B, Painting Life. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio by Steve Paulson, Veronica Rickert, Charles Monroe Kane, Anne Strainchamps, Doug Gordon, and Mary Lou Finnegan, with engineering help from Marv Nunn.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Since the explosion of surfing in the 60s, Hanging 10 has become one of the coolest sports around. Today, women, children, and seniors surf their way across peaks of blue water. I'm Jim Fleming. Next time on To the Best of Our Knowledge, how one young man fell in love with the ocean and made the journey from beach bum to surfing rabbi. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.